Flustered, Angela Sullivan gathered the folder, slapped it onto the glass-topped coffee table. Some of the contents slithered out and fanned across the surface. "Perhaps you could take us through it," Orr said, gesturing at the paperwork. Sullivan flipped open the folder and picked up the first sheet. She frowned at it, thrust it at Orr. A name, monthly dates, and amounts in smudged ballpoint. "John Allard," said Orr, looking at Claire. "He moved in mid-November 1998, stayed 2 years." "If that's what it says, that's what it says," Sullivan said. Claire scribbled the name and dates in her notebook. "Do you know his whereabouts now, Angela?"
"You think it could be him?"
She gave herself gentle slaps to the cheeks. One side, the other. "No, can't be him."
"Are you sure?"
"I saw him last year. He bought a place in Langwarren. Can't be him." All picked through the remaining rental records. Paltry, approximate, hand-scrawled. But he found Donna Crowther. A woman named Donna Crowther rented the house from Christmas 2001 until mid-2005.
"Yes, Donna. That sounds about right."
Claire said, "Did she have a boyfriend?" Elaborately vague, Sullivan said, "I think so." With a shift in his tone, Orr said, "Angela, we talked to some of the neighbours. Donna had a boyfriend and they often argued, fought."
"Yes?"
"We heard the boyfriend was there one day, gone the next."
"I really wouldn't know. I didn't have much to do with them. They were tenants."
"Do you happen to know where Donna lives now?"
"Somewhere in Carrum, I think."
"Do you stay in touch with her?"
"No."
"But you do have an address for her? Phone number?"
"No,"
Angela Sullivan said, looking hunted. All said, "Donna Crowther was your last tenant?" Sullivan glanced up and shifted her jaw from side to side as if severely taxed by the question, before nodding, "Yes."
"Why?"
"Your mother was still alive. Still needed the money. She let the property stay vacant from 2005 until her death, what, 6 years later?"
"Well, if you must know, the house was a wreck. Fibro, holes in the walls for the rats to get in, rusty roofing iron, badly in need of a re-stumping, loose floorboards, you name it. We couldn't afford to fix it up, and it wasn't in a fit state to rent to anyone.
So after Donna Crowther moved out, the house sat vacant for several years. Then you demolished it to make the land seem more desirable to buyers?"
She whispered. "Yes."
"This is very important, Angela. You would have looked inside the house before it was demolished? Taken out any valuable fixtures, that kind of thing?"
"Don't really recall."
"Angela," said Orr, disappointed.
"Okay, all right. I had a look through it. For the first time in years, actually. The fireplace surround was quite lovely, so I pulled it out and sold it to a dealer."
"Did you see any signs of a struggle?"
She blanched.
"What sort of signs?"
"Blood on the floor or walls," said Orr, with an edge to his voice.
"Fresh holes in the walls or floorboards. Or failing that, fresh signs that the place had been cleaned, painted, patched." Looking at her gnarled hands again, she said,
"Nothing like that."
"Who carried out the demolition?"
"Oh, come on."
She shook her head, a little too emphatically for Orr's liking.
"It was years ago. And I was still grieving the death of my mother, plus talking to the real estate people, and I had debts to clear and my health wasn't that good."
All waited.
"Just a name on a flyer in my letterbox," she said at last.
"Some man who advertised home maintenance and repairs. All I had was a mobile number. I didn't keep it." "A home maintenance guy demolished the house. How? Did he have the right equipment? Where did he take the rubbish? How did you pay him?"
"He said he'd recycle most of it. Lovely pressed tin ceilings, wood mouldings, that kind of thing. Any wood that wasn't rotten, he'd turn into kindling. It was a small house. I think he got some of his mates in and they stripped it and carted it all off in trailers."
By now, she was sounding confident. She had a story she was sticking to, and she was tired of them. She had nothing more to give them except repetition. All compared notes with Pascal in the car afterwards, the sun beating against the glass.
a sense that Angela Sullivan was watching them from her sitting room. Or maybe she was eyeing the boys tinkering with their car. God, he was weary after a day of running around the state. Maybe the real estate agent saw something, he said. Claire was staring at the house glumly. She got twitchy a couple of times. She did, agreed all. The house, or maybe the demolition. And Crowther. The woman who told me about Crowther said she stayed on for at least a year after her boyfriend disappeared. Pretty calculating to shoot your boyfriend, bury him next to the house, and carry on as if nothing had happened. Yes, but does the timeline work? And if she did shoot and bury her boyfriend and stay on in the house, she'd need to clean up, meaning it's pointless asking anyone if they saw blood or brains or bullet holes. True, said Orr. Or Slab Man is not her boyfriend, but a stranger, buried later and she had nothing to do with any of it. Claire grunted. They continued to muse. All said, what if squatters moved in after Crowther moved out? Pascal groaned. That means talking to the neighbours again. Or Angela is lying. Give her the benefit of the doubt first, All said. He lowered his window. Late afternoon air flowed through the car, faintly scented by petrol and exhaust fumes. There was an explosive backfire, smoke wreathing the little Subaru. The street racers backed away from the car, waving at the fumes, casting embarrassed looks at All and Pascal in the cold case car. Get a job, Claire muttered. Chapter 14. Evening now. All at the kitchen table with his laptop, the house mostly silent around him. He'd keyed in parental alienation syndrome. Curious that Neve's lawyer, in a rare flash of animation that morning, had thought Kelso was drawing on the theory, and curious to know why it had been discredited. PAS, he read, was the brainchild of an American child psychiatrist named Richard Gardner in the 1980s. The theory grew quickly in favour and influence, spreading from the US to the UK, Canada, and Australia, and held that children affected by the syndrome had been brainwashed by one parent to denigrate or allege abuse against the other. Typically, such children used foul language against the accused or rejected parent, insisted their allegations were not coaxed, and were protective and supportive of the non-accused parent. All sat back. He hadn't seen or heard anything like that from Pia. She didn't talk about her father. Or not to me, he thought. He read on. According to Gardner, PAS was found mostly in custody cases where child sexual abuse was alleged. The solution? The child should be removed from the alienating parent, usually the mother, and placed with the alleged abuser, usually the father. Gardner went on to suggest that mother-child contact should cease for long periods, and mothers who persisted in their abuse allegations should be jailed. Not only that, he believed that most sexual abuse allegations were false. In a book published in 1992, he argued that hysteria attended such allegations in the context of an overly moralistic and primitive understanding of pedophilia. The tendency of a father to seek gratification from a child could be reduced, he argued, if therapists treating child sex abuse victims helped the mother become more sexually responsive. All was stunned. He poured a scotch and read on. Eventually, Gardner was discredited. He'd never treated children and was accused of demonizing women. Finally, the family court in Australia disavowed PAS. But were all judges and single experts up to speed? Was some ignoring the shift? Dressing PAS up in softer language? Neve hadn't alleged sexual abuse, though. So Justice Messer was justified in slapping down Fleet when he tried to suggest Kelso was arguing parental alienation syndrome. But did Kelso believe PAS applied in all instances of abuse, including the plain old violent kind? All googled Messer. A Melbourne grammar boy, educated at the University of Melbourne and later Columbia in the US, resided in Brighton. Divorced, no children. Belonged to a couple of predominantly male business and social organisations, and was a stern fixture in Anglican church circles. Then all dug more deeply into Kelso, finding a couple of less formal sites. Apparently, the psychiatrist had no particular training in recognizing or treating sexual abuse in children. Hadn't been obliged to reach a level of expertise before becoming a single expert. Yet he'd been called on to evaluate several hundred families, and was regularly used in cases featuring highly contentious allegations of physical and sexual abuse. He'd been reported as saying that 90% of the child sexual abuse allegations he'd assessed were false, which didn't square, all read, with the view of many of his peers that 90% of such allegations in fact had substance. A 2-year-old newspaper piece quoted Kelso saying there'd been some differences of opinion about the efficacy of PAS, but clinically, it was a useful concept in some circumstances. Useful in all your circumstances, all muttered. As the evening deepened, all brooded. Men like Kelso, Fanning, Alec Neal. Their assumptions, cronyism, power, sense of entitlement. Preemptive strike kinds of men. They seized the advantage while the rest of the world was thinking things through. Like Neil, with his accusations against his wife, thought all. And as soon as we move against him, he'll surround himself with lawyers and colleagues. All couldn't deny it. Neil obsessed him. 3 deaths. The first wife might have died naturally, but he doubted it. Her queasiness, gradually getting worse over several days. It indicated some kind of poison. Not the same kind that killed Siobhan and Christine. But then, although arrogant, Neil wasn't stupid. He wouldn't use the same drug 3 times in a row. Quite suddenly, a deeper unease settled in all. Saturday morning, Janine Neil, pale, dizzy, uncoordinated. She'd speculated blithely that Neil might shoot her or push her off a rock. But what if he'd poisoned her? Surely he couldn't be that arrogant. But he'd succeeded 3 times before. Maybe he thought he was untouchable. All phoned Janine. Mobile and landline. No answer. He sat and thought very carefully, then dug around in an old sleeping bag for one of the protective clothing packs he'd scrounged over the years, working crime scenes. He dressed in dark clothing, backed his elderly Saab out of the garage and headed across to East Melbourne, heart jumpy and mouth dry. Parking against a dark, leafy curb a few blocks from the Neil house, he checked for surveillance. Was unsurprised to see none. The department hadn't the resources for around-the-clock watches on the Neils. But he entered the property via the laneway at the rear anyway. He tested the back door and found it unlocked, as if Janine were at home and not yet in bed. Except there were no lights on. At that moment, however, all had no need of lights. He was familiar with the odors of sickness and death. And whatever slimy stuff he was treading in, he was thankful he had forensic overshoes on his feet. Chapter 15. Alan All didn't go home. Didn't call anyone. Midnight. A brilliant moon. He drove Janine Neal's Jetta northeast out of the city, taking minor streets and roads as much as possible. He couldn't avoid all of the CCTV cameras, but it wasn't his car, and he had the sun visors down, a cap over his brow. Even so, he made a wide loop through Eltham and Yarra Glen and the farmland around Kinglake, north of St Andrews, before turning south. A play of tricky light and shade across the roads, the moon striking through the trees. A distant red flicker that proved to be a dying bonfire in the middle of a harrowed paddock. Further heaped pine trees and branch litter awaiting the match. Finally, the Maps app on Janine Neal's phone took him to a driveway on a region of wooded hills and dirt roads. He drove past for 1 kilometre, parked behind an abandoned fruit and vegetable store. Deleted maps from the phone. He ditched his first forensic suit in a builder's skip. He pulled on another, all but the gloves and overshoes, pocketed a small torch, and walked back to the Neil driveway. The hour of the fox, he thought. He still didn't know what he was doing. Knew enough for self-preservation, however, thinking of the driveway, of powdery dirt holding shoe impressions. He parted fence wires and slipped onto the property that way, crossing a lightly wooded slope to the house. Good. The garage door was up. Fitting the overshoes to his feet, the gloves to his hands, he entered. He felt around under the workbench. No metal box. The rifle was not where Janine Neal had said it would be. And then Alec Neal said, "This is harassment!" His voice was a squeak. He was as scared as all, but he was armed and all wasn't. "I saw you. Got up for a glass of water and there you were, glowing like a light bulb in that white suit." All said nothing, kept his hands where Neal could see them. "Any reason you're dressed like that? You look like you've got something messy in mind." Neal was in the shadows beside his car, a black Porsche Cayenne. All darted a glance out at the moon-soaked slope of land leading down to the road. He could run. He could get shot in the back if he ran. Or he'd make it out safely and Neal would call the local cops. Or Debenham. Colfax. Either way, all was finished. His mouth was dry. "What did you use on Janine? Same poison you used on your first wife?" Neal stepped into a patch of brighter light. He wore pajamas, paint-splattered blue Crocs on his feet. His hair was askew from his pillow, and the rifle shook minutely in his hands. He held it as if he didn't know what it was. "But you don't need to be an expert to shoot an old 22," thought Orr. "Where are the others?" Neal said, the rifle absently turning away from Orr as he risked a quick look out at the empty night. Before Orr could act, man and rifle swung back. In that short time, Neal had gathered himself. His voice was steady, laced with undisguised sardonic amusement as he said, "It's just you, right?" "Just me." Neal grinned. "This is going to be good." And his eyes were aglow. All saw the madness there at last. "What is?" In reply, Neal motioned with the rifle, a busy get-a-move-on up-and-down jerk of the barrel. "Inside." Inside, where he'd call the police. Shoot all the intruder. All didn't move. "In," I said. More gesturing. Impatience when all didn't move. But all was watching the rifle, timing his move. He'd need 2 seconds, and suspected he had only one. The barrel tip is trained on his chest, then it's bisecting his face. It reaches the ceiling, and now it's tracing a downward arc. The action repeated again and again, expressing contempt and pure arrogance. "I'm not fucking around, Sergeant. Move!" Another gesture and all charged, covering half the distance before the rifle barrel was fully up, slamming into Neal as it came down. The men grappled, the rifle trapped between them. Neal tried to push him away with it. Neal was strong, wiry. All, despite his morning walks, was the older man. Then Neal slipped on an oil patch and all followed him down, tangled and desperate as their sweaty hands fought for control of the little rifle, and then it was at an awkward angle, and then it went off. All sprawled, panting on the floor, waiting for his senses to return. Neal had toppled onto his side, the rifle tangled under him, his cheek on the cement, revealing his jaw. The entry wound. No exit wound. Not with a little 22. And not much blood yet. But it was leaking down inside the collar of the man's pajama top. It would stain the cement soon. All moved at last, badly panicked. He ran to the bench, ran once around the interior of the garage, trying to think. A painter's drop cloth, still in its cellophane wrapper. He tore it open, spread it on the cement floor, rolled Neal onto it, wrapped him in it, finally, and carted him outside onto the lawn. He listened. He hadn't seen other houses nearby, and the barrel had been pressed under Neil's jaw, muffling the shot. What next? His actions seemed inevitable. Like everything he'd done this evening, aimed at concealment. The hour of the fox, he thought. The hour when a hobby farmer might take his 22 rifle to henhouse marauders. Or shoot himself because his wife was leaving him. Or because he was a killer and couldn't stand the guilt a moment longer. All was improvising here. He went with the fox. All, the old homicide cop. It was instructive, carting Neil's body by the light of the moon. To understand at last the weight of the human body, its lumpen intractability in death. He skirted a broad, neatly plotted area of rose bushes at the rear of the house and crossed a patch of grass to a barbed wire fence, separating the Neil property from empty paddocks and distant trees. He choreographed the death of a man who had gone after a fox in the nighttime and overbalanced while climbing a fence. A man with his right foot tangled between the first and second wires, and his torso on the other side. His shoulders on the ground and his face staring blankly at the sky. Barbed wire tears on his calf, arms and torso. A rifle near his outstretched right hand. The wound under his jaw. Then all stood back. He'd constructed a narrative. What narrative would investigators construct? All didn't admire his work, but eyed it critically. He asked himself the questions a man like Debenham would ask. The length of Neil's arms. The length of the rifle. Was he right or left-handed? Whose gun? Satisfied, he crossed back to the house, entering via a connecting door in the garage. A faint odor of curry and human habitation. Working as rapidly as he could, and using 30 years of police experience, he searched every room. Behind the bathtub skirting, behind PowerPoints, under the toilet lids, inside shampoo bottles and lumpy packs of frozen peas, the floor space under bottom drawers. He found two ampoules of succinylcholine inside a laser printer, one labeled Cabrini, the other Peninsula Private. Pocketed one, left the other where it would be found in about 2 minutes. All stopped at the unknown neighbor's bonfire on his return trip, burned the forensic clothing and the drop sheet and cellophane, and walked gingerly back to the car with his shoes in his hands, trouser legs rolled, socks in his pockets. A clever forensic technician might trace the soil on his feet to this paddock, but all hoped to have showered multiple times before that happened. A fast run back to the city, his nerves jangling, waiting for something to happen. An abrupt swamping of guilt, sirens, the alarm going off, time to wake up. He tried to search his feelings. Remorse? Shame? Glee? Fear? Chest-thumping sense of righteousness? None of the above. But the jumpy nerves meant something. That he'd killed a man? More than that. He didn't want to get caught. He'd covered his tracks. He was careful, oblique, a shadow slipping in and away again. Bundle of nerves, though. 30 minutes later, he was swapping cars and heading for Carlton, thinking inexplicably of Liz. He hadn't expected the break, but he hadn't been surprised by it either. And he hadn't argued. There was no fighting or bitterness, just acceptance tinged with regret. He wondered what Liz would think if she ever learned about the night he'd just had. She'd always thought him slightly inert, undermotivated, content with his own company, absorbed in his own thoughts. Would this change her opinion? Couldn't tell her about it, of course. Couldn't tell a soul. Chapter 16. Tuesday. All did not vary his routine. He walked. He took the tram to work and made calls and checked records. A picture of diligence. But as the morning progressed, he found himself controlling external indicators of stress. Shoulder tension, jaw clenching, his right leg jiggling. Every time footsteps passed the cold case main door, or anyone entered the office to check a matter with Bug, Pascal, Colfax, he believed the sword of judgment was about to fall. Hadn't the bodies been found yet? He'd already checked his private and work emails. Clumsily worded offers of anal sex with beautiful Russian women. Unmissable deals from online store sites he'd never visited. Nothing from Tasmania. No recent suspicious deaths in East Melbourne or St. Andrews. Half an hour later, he checked again, and some of the anxiety lifted. A new message. Launceston police had visited the address listed on Roger Vance's Land Cruiser registration papers. According to neighbours, who continued to stay in touch, forwarding the occasional letter, Vance had moved out 4 or 5 years earlier. lived in Victoria now, an address in Mo, not so far from the late John Elphick's farm. A familiar and welcome sensation replaced the anxiety, the hunt. All thought about Vance, forming a mental picture. A man who hadn't bothered to take out Victorian registration on the Land Cruiser because it was an effort, an irritation. A man who didn't look far ahead, wouldn't factor in the risk of attracting police or bureaucratic attention. Vance was the kind of killer who'd drive around with broken taillights and a body wrapped in a blanket. All made a series of phone calls. Roger Vance still lived in Mo. He was deeply in debt, on a community service order for drug possession, finding occasional work as a farrier, in horse country where farriers were thick on the ground. Knocking on the boss's door, poking his head in, all said, "I found the guy who might have killed Elphick." Colfax, about to make a phone call, replaced the handset. "Where?" "He lives in Mo now. Moved there a few years ago. I'd like to question him."
"Mo? Christ, that's halfway across the state."
She exaggerated. "Until we have a face for Slabman, we're at a standstill," all said. With a sudden dryness in his mouth, he added, "And the Neil business has nothing to do with us until homicide finish with it. So I'd like to move on Vance before his old Tasmanian neighbours tell him we've been sniffing around." Helen waved a hand at all, wincing as if the action hurt her head.
"Okay, okay, major point."
She patted her pockets absently for cigarettes.
"Not entirely at a standstill. You still need to find Donna Crowther."
All said nothing. Let her stew on his request. Finally, looking at her watch, she said,
"I don't want you going down there by yourself. Take Claire or Josh with you. And contact the local station and see if they'll provide a couple of uniforms.
A wise boss is a revered boss." Helen was still looking for her non-existent smokes.
"Question him at the local station in the first instance."
"Deeply revered." She sighed.
"Alan, just piss off, all right?"
All called Mo Police, arranged backup, signed out a car, and by late morning he and Pascal were heading east. They rode in silence, all driving, the motion of the car and the growl of the tires encouraging reflection. No spring light today, only a dank and sunless sky. Claire looked over.
"Is anything wrong?"
All realized he had the steering wheel in a death grip. He breathed in and out and let some of the tension drain away. The bodies would have been found by now. Forces must be moving against him. He cleared his throat.
"I'm fine."
"In that case, how about you give me a bit more detail about this excursion instead of sitting there as if you'd rather be somewhere else?" Rebuked, all outlined the backstory. Elphick, Vance, the Land Cruiser, the ferry trip. Claire chewed on that as the landscape unfolded.
"But you don't have actual proof of anything."
All shrugged. "The elegant neatness, it all comes together.
All he has to do is deny."
"He can't deny the number plate, clear as mud on the cover of a notebook kept by a man he'd fallen out with, who died violently.
You know what a lawyer will do with that. There's no way of proving when the number plate was written down. It could date back to when this Vance character worked for him."
"You're a bit of a killjoy, really, aren't you?" all said. He said it lightly, with humour, which he thought was an achievement given the state he was in. They rode into Mo on a tide of muted goodwill. Roger Vance lived in a block of flats, three up, three down, at the edge of town. A short, sad, overlooked street behind a timber yard. The kind of place where trees were a blight and weed clearing was someone else's job. At the curb, a police divvy van. Glimpsed in the cramped residence parking at the rear, a Holden ute with a built-in metal canopy, stenciled, "Horse Sense Farrier."
"Let's hope he hasn't got any," Claire muttered.
"Let's hope he's home." They parked and got out. The police van was empty, but all could see the local uniforms now, on the doorstep of a bottom flat. He could also see what they couldn't. Roger Vance in the side yard, scurrying for his ute. Claire grinned.
"You go one way, I'll go the other."
She paused.
If you're up to it. I'll throw my Zimmer frame at him. Claire sprinted the long way around, passing the local police, calling, "Quicken the dead, boys!" All took the shorter route, down the side path. By now, Vance had reached his ute, but, panicked by police knocking on his door, the running footsteps behind him, was fumbling his keys. He dropped them, bent to retrieve them, couldn't find the right key. Gave up on all that and darted a crazy look over his shoulder at all. A pouchy face full of aggravations. Red hair and eyebrows and sallow skin. As though he'd walked off a dust bowl farm. Shorts, a t-shirt, runners with trailing laces. He turned from all, tensing to bolt the other way. The sole of one shoe stepped on a lace from the other and Claire was there, blocking his exit, placing a palm flat against his chest. "You going to behave?" Vance reversed direction, as if he might dodge around all. The same shoelace messed with that. "You want to smarten up before you leave the house," Claire said. "Didn't your mother teach you that?" "Fuck you." "Also, language?" "Fucking bitch." All said, "Settle down. Are you Roger Vance?" "Who wants to know?" Name and rank, then all said they needed to ask him a few questions. "At the police station, please." Vance had been born sullen. His disappointments were gathered on his face and in his voice. "What about?" The Mo uniforms appeared finally, unhurried. The older one saying, "Guess you didn't need us after all." "If you could transport Mr. Vance to the lockup," all said, "we'll follow." "That's all we're good for," the Mo cop said, grinning. A Mo police station interview room. Vance sulky. "I don't know what's going on. I don't even know if I'm under arrest." Across the table from him, all shifted to get comfortable in an unsafe plastic chair. "We simply want to ask you some questions." Vance was a twitchy mess. "So I can, like, go if I wanted." Claire, in a similar chair beside all, was bored and contemptuous. "Look at it this way, Rog. Roger? Roger the Dodger? The moment you leave this room, we arrest you for resisting arrest, and you said I wasn't under arrest. And assaulting a police officer. That's a fucking lie." "Or," said all, "no big deal. You answer a few questions regarding a case we're working on and we take you home." Vance was pale and clammy. Hadn't showered or shaved, and a dank, murky odor gusted from the neck of his shirt. "Up to you," all continued.
"This is bullshit," Vance said.
Some years had passed since the murder, and it was entirely possible he'd forgotten it, shelved it, and was thinking of a more recent crime. A minor theft. Speeding. The weed hidden in his bedroom. He shot glances at the two detectives, as if trying to decide what was worse. All's unreadable mildness, or Pascal's hostility. All came in hard. "On the 13th of October, 2011, you overnighted on the car ferry from Devonport to Melbourne. On the 14th, you drove to Drysdale and murdered John Elphick. You caught the return ferry later that same day."
"What?"
Vance reeled.
"What are you saying?"
"Records have you on the Spirit of Tasmania, Roger. You came over on the 13th, left again on the night of the 14th. Quick killing trip. We even have a digital CCTV image of you on the ferry."
"What?"
"Let's go back to a period before your little trip. Life was hard. Plus, you were always fucking up. Do a bit of work, fuck up, get the sack. After you got the sack from John Elphick, you decided to give it a go down in Tasmania. Of course, you came a guster there, too. And so eventually you got it into your head that it was all Mr. Elphick's fault," Claire said. "We're not unreasonable, Roger," all said. "As we understand it, Elphick could be a bit of a prick."
"You can say that again," Vance said.
And now all knew they had him. Arrogant, would you say? A perfectionist? Always having a go at something. Even his family hated him. All had no idea if that was true, but it resonated with Vance. He flicked his tongue over his lips, swallowing.
"Totally unfair what that asshole done to me."
His eyes narrowed, a look of calculation chasing away the wounded air.
"But I never laid a finger on him. Never went near the bastard. I come over to Melbourne to see a mate. You knew Mr. Elphick had died, though.
A shrug.
Heard it somewhere.
Perhaps on the news.
I guess so. I'm not much of a news person.
You came over to see a mate. This mate have a name? Phone number?
I think he's gone back to the UK. We sort of lost touch.
Claire Pascal said,
Why would you want to stab Mr. Elphick?
I never stabbed him,
Vance said with a touch of scorn. He gathered himself to put her right on the details, remembered where he was, shut his jaws with a click.
He taped it,
all said.
What?
Taped the whole thing on his phone. You shouting at him like a whiny kid. Him telling you to piss off. The sounds of a struggle. No problem for the lab to match the voice print of this interview to his recording.
All bullshit.
But they hadn't arrested him yet, so no caution. And no lawyer present. All slid a photograph across the chipped table surface. And to top it all off, here's a note he made of your number plate. He saw an unfamiliar vehicle pulling alongside the fence, wrote down the plate number. Vance stared at it. All nudged it closer. Vance reared as if it might strike.
Go on, look closely.
Vance worked his dry mouth. He looked for a way out. His eyes filled.
Fucking ruined me, that cunt.
Chapter 17. All dangled the car keys at Claire.
You drive.
But before she could turn on the ignition, her phone pinged with an incoming text. All waited, a part of him certain the caller was Debenham or Colfax, ordering her to arrest him. He could see tension rising in Claire. They were telling her to watch her back. Then, as the seconds lengthened and she didn't move, simply stared at her phone, he said,
What?
Something wrong? She blinked awake.
Nothing. Look, would you mind driving?
Sure,
Orr said, getting out. Whatever had unsettled her, it didn't seem to relate to him.
Something personal?
He walked around the front of the car, Pascal the rear. She looked pale, suddenly, drained of energy. When he was strapped in behind the steering wheel, he said, Claire, tell me. She said miserably, My best friend just texted me.
Okay.
She says my husband's having an affair.
Hell, said Orr.
He reached out to touch her arm, saw the hideous ridged scars where her cuffs had ridden up and thought better of it. Pascal didn't move. Her hand was white-knuckled around her phone. Orr reached for it.
May I?
She didn't resist. He read the screen.
Does, thought you should know. Michael shagging Oxley. Call me, okay? Love you, Jess.
Followed by a string of emojis. Sad face. Wailing face. Puzzled face. Red angry face. Green sick face. All shook his head. The best friend relates some earth-shattering news by text message?
I'm really sorry, he said.
Pause. Have you known Jess for long? Distracted, Claire said,
Since primary school. She wouldn't... She's not playing games.
No, she's really there for you, thought Orr, sourly. He didn't understand modern etiquette. He handed back the phone. Claire took it, still shocked, teary, bewildered.
I knew he was up to something.
Who's Oxley?
Deb Oxley, a friend of ours.
Former friend. All started the car. Late afternoon by the time we get back. Why don't I take you straight home? Claire slapped her hands to her cheeks.
For me to do what? Wait for Michael to walk in the door? I'm not ready for that. I can't think.
So, back to the office?
No. I mean, yes. No. I don't know what to do.
Could you stay with this Jess person? Pascal gave an empty laugh.
She lives across the street.
And no, I don't like her boyfriend. Lives across the street, Orr thought, but too much trouble to walk a few metres and give Claire the news in person, along with a comforting hug. Look, I have a spare room. Come and stay with me until you sort out what you want to do. She blinked at him. Well, that's kind of you, but I couldn't. No, no, it's a huge old place in Carlton. My daughter lives there. Various international students and odds and sods in need of a temporary roof over their heads. Claire Pascal was distracted enough to say, Really? I had this image of you as a sad old bastard in a bachelor flat, Orr said. But actually, I'm a sad bastard with a spare room in a big house. A long pause.
Can I think about it?
Deal, Orr said, putting the car in gear. Presently, he said, What does he do, your husband? He's in IT. What can you say to that? All drove. And finally, breaking a silence that had lasted until they were crossing the eastern suburbs, Claire Pascal said, Is your spare room still available? Last time I looked. First, a quick stop at her house. Claire directed all to a narrow, sloping side street in Abbotsford, a tight squeeze between residents' cars on either side.
Drive past, she said,
ducking below the sill of her side window. All glanced at the house as he steered along the street. A cream weatherboard with a Brunswick green door and window frames, a few shrubs in the pocket handkerchief front garden, an empty carport.
He's not home yet,
Claire said, sitting upright. She pointed to a house across the street.
That's Jess's driveway. Pull in there. She won't be home yet either.
All guessed this was a street where you knew your neighbor's business. He barely knew who his neighbors were. Drummond Street was broad, with big houses and busy lives and a fast turnover of students in houses like his own. Want me to come in with you? She shook her head.
Toot if you see a white Golf pull into my driveway and I'll slip out the back.
She was quick. 5 minutes. Returning to the car with a stuffed gym bag and a suitcase on wheels bumping over the bitumen's cracks and erosions. All said, Toothbrush? Comb? Phone charger? PJs? Spare... things? Claire looked at him. She was ready for some lightness and humour, but she'd also just walked out on her husband and was wound tight. And Orr was a much older man, a work colleague she barely knew, taking her to a room in his house. Second thoughts chased each other across her face. Orr stopped teasing, gave her a sad, sweet smile. Ignore me. All set? As I'll ever be. They returned the car to the police garage and caught a tram along St Kilda Road and up through the city to Carlton. Early evening now. The city streets teeming with people knocking off work or heading to evening classes or pre-show meals in Chinatown. Claire, lulled by the tram, fell silent. She stared out, registering nothing. They alighted outside the university and walked across Carlton to Orr's house. Claire stared.
You live here?
In all its glory. I mean, it's yours.
Yes.
She gave him a look.
Are you rich?
She caught herself, shook herself. Sorry, none of my business. Inherited the place when my parents died, Orr said. Not rich. I might be comfortable if I sold it, I suppose, after giving my wife her share. Claire stood her wheelie case upright on the footpath while Orr patted his pockets for his keys.
I somehow thought you were divorced.
Separated, but friends.
Where does she live?
Here, part of the time. Claire glanced doubtfully at the house, at Orr.
I don't know, Al.
Look, it's fine. No tension. Nothing to worry about.
If you say so.
But isn't it weird, her living here too? It's only some of the time, Orr said.
Claire Pascal's expressions were fleeting. Pity. Puzzlement. Sympathy. What have I got myself into? Acceptance, finally, which was okay by all. He could see, though, that he would never be quite the same man in her eyes. Whatever works, right? She said. Whatever works. She grabbed her suitcase handle and squared her shoulders. Anything else I should know? Like strange pairings and weird fetishes. For starters, there's a cat named Cynthia. I can cope with a cat. Not sure about the name. Meanwhile, the human population is quite normal. My daughter sometimes has a boyfriend to stay. A couple of postgrad students, including a married couple from Sri Lanka, live here. And a woman and her daughter who need somewhere to doss down during a custody battle. And me, Claire Pascal said. A pathetic workmate running out on her husband. You wouldn't be the first one, all said, finding the correct key. Noticing the crack in Claire's voice, the slump of her shoulders, he gave her a brief, hard hug and showed her into Chateau Hall. The first thing to happen was Pia charging down the corridor to greet him, skidding to a halt when she saw Claire. Hello? Hello? Claire said, shooting all a glance. Then, sensing Cynthia winding around her ankles, she looked down. And hello to you. That's Cynthia, Pia said. Are you allergic? No. What's your name? Claire. Are you AA's girlfriend? All looked on with interest. No, Claire Pascal said. She paused. We work together. And we're friends. Bub showed Claire to the spare room. He calls me Bub, Pia said, clattering away down the corridor to the junk room. There's the bathroom. There's the kitchen. That's upstairs, she said, pointing. Okay. All relieved himself of wallet, keys, and jacket, changed into jeans and a t-shirt, and headed for the junk room. Pascal was sitting on the bed, texting. I'm just texting the husband. All moved boxes of junk into the corridor and left her to it. Presently, Beck came downstairs, in a pre-exam cramming daze. Neve appeared, still in her cleaner's overalls, and Tiv and his wife walked in with meat and vegetables from an Asian grocery and announced they were cooking. It was as good a start for Claire Pascal as all could have hoped for. Chapter 18. Wednesday. All walked, showered, and by 7 a.m. was reading The Age as he ate his muesli and listened to the ABC News. According to floor thumps and gurgles in the pipes, Neve and Pia were showering. Beck would emerge at 9:55 to start work at 10 o'clock in Gugor's Gifts around the corner. Tiv and Shireen were flying to Sydney for a conference. All didn't know when he'd see Liz again. The doctoral student in the room next to his had crept in late last night, out again at dawn. He hadn't clapped eyes on her for a month. Thus was his life. That left his newest waif or stray, and she entered the kitchen tentatively, hair damp, scowling. I drank too much last night. There's muesli, eggs in the fridge. Claire shuddered. And coffee in the pot. Another shudder, possibly of relief. She sat at the table with him and sipped coffee, reviving in stages, life coming into her face, eyes, neck, hands. Not much joy, though. Suspicion, if anything. Suspicion in the hard look she gave all, as if waiting for a particular response. Wondering what, if anything, he'd done wrong, he said, "What? This is weird for me." All pushed cereal bowl, Age, and radio aside and folded his arms. Okay. Makes sense for us to go to work together. It does. But that feels weird, Alan. I kind of think we need to travel separately. You've let me stay a night, and I appreciate it, but we need to maintain a professional distance. He could see from her face that she was uncomfortable with the term, but had used it for want of another.
"Whatever makes you feel comfortable," he said.
"Yet it's logical to travel together."
"Uh-huh.
But it's not as if we're friends, or, heaven forbid, in a relationship." All said, "I'm guessing a tiny corner of you is wondering what my intentions are." She blushed. All held his arms wide.
"You've seen the place, the people who live here. You're the latest in a long line. I've not had a relationship with a single one of them. I don't imagine you'll stay long, but I'm pleased to be able to offer you a roof over your head while you decide what it is you want to do. If you want to stay on, then I'm happy to rent the room to you. Dirt cheap, by the way."
"Look," he said, "it's a big house, and a real waste to leave rooms empty when they're so scarce in the inner city."
He paused. "You can always lock your door at night."
She shot him a hard look, then saw the glint in his eye.
"Yeah, yeah."
All returned to his breakfast and news gathering, and presently Claire said, "Michael's in a mess. Keeps texting me. Calling me. It gave him a shock, me not going home last night. But I'm not ready to see him just yet. I don't want to race back and make him feel better. I just need to think for a few days."
If the job allows, Orr thought.
He wondered what sort of mess the husband was in. A genuine mess, or an expedient one? A mess to tug at his wife's heartstrings? He said, "Okay by me, Claire." Claire glanced around the kitchen helplessly. "I should help with the food and cooking, I suppose." "Claire, get yourself some breakfast, for God's sake." She winced. "Okay if I have some porridge?"
"Go for your life.
I hate muesli.
So have some porridge."
"This is a ridiculous conversation."
"Yes."
Claire looked away, back down the kitchen to doss down, then up at the ceiling, as if divining the floors, bedrooms, and people above. It occurred to all that she might already have formed a connection to his house. She'd had fun last night, the food and wine and odd company. He didn't know if that would be a good or a bad thing for her. They took the tram to work, and as soon as they neared the main doors to the police building, she said, "Fuck!"
"What?"
"It's Michael." The husband was a solid, athletic guy in his 30s. Narrow suit, neat hair but full of hard stares, sullenness and sour coffee jitters.
"Who's the boyfriend?"
"Michael, please." All took a step back, scorched by the guy's fury, then stepped forward, sticking his hand out. "I work with Claire." Michael Pascal ignored him, his face breaking in a spluttering display of grief.
"Please, Claire, I can't stand it. Please, come back."
Claire's shoulders slumped. She stepped closer to her husband, patted him reluctantly, cast all a complicated look.
"I've got this, and I wish you hadn't seen him like this, and don't worry about me."
All nodded and went upstairs to the cold case office.
"Don't get comfortable," Helen Colfax told him. "You're coming with me."
She paused, looking around the main office.
"Where's Claire?"
"Not in yet."
A tense little fist clenching in his gut.
"Where are we going?"
"St. Andrews."
All tried to work moisture over his tongue as he followed her to the lift.
"Is this about the Neils?"
Helen pushed the button for the garage. She'd had a haircut. It was softly shaped and feathery around her face, but didn't suit her. Her body seemed to thrum, ready for action, impatient with the lift. All said again,
"Boss, the Neils?"
She gathered herself.
"Janine is dead. Her sister found her this morning after failing to get hold of her yesterday and last night."
"Dead how?"
Still needing a distraction, Colfax compared her sleeve lengths. One was midway along her forearm, the other to her elbow. She rolled the longer one up and said,
"Good question. How dumb do you think the husband is?"
"Not dumb, but arrogant."
"Exactly.
The first indications are she'd had a seizure of some kind.
Poisoned?
Succinylcholine? Colfax shook her head. She'd vomited, and her body was twisted from the seizure. Not like a heart attack, according to the preliminary examination. She looked at all. And not quite the symptoms of the first wife either. But would Neil really try three different methods? Would he be that stupid?
He'd use something very difficult to trace, Paul said.
They found the car, an unmarked white Holden, and Helen drove. Where Claire Pascal was nervous at the wheel, Colfax was brisk and fast. All said, "Does Debenham know?"
"He's meeting us there. I want to crack at Neil before it's taken away from us. I want to watch his face."
"Crocodile tears?"
"Probably."
All's tension began to ebb. "We need to check his browsing history." Colfax shook her head. "Alan, the guy's a surgeon, surrounded by books and academic papers and fellow experts and access to drugs. We're not going to find out he's keyed in how to kill my wife with an undetectable poison." "Still..."
"How did it go in Mo yesterday?"
"He confessed," All said.
"Really?"
She peered over.
"Good on you.
So you're clear to concentrate on Slabman now, okay? Josh thinks he's tracked down an address for Donald Crowther. If she's not involved, we need to release his face to the media," All said.
"Almost ready, apparently,"
Colfax said.
"Possibly tomorrow."
The car rolled through the northern suburbs and eventually to an area more rural than urban.
"Do you have a search warrant for Neil?"
"Debenham does. Turning up mob-handed with a search warrant, maybe the good doctor will fold quickly." "Not a chance," All said. "He'll clam up and refuse to speak without a lawyer."
"A girl can dream."
They passed the bonfire paddock. Nothing but an ash pile and a thread of smoke now. And all felt a giddy elation and terror. What if this was an elaborate trap? He'd been caught on a security camera he'd failed to spot. Or Neil was still alive. The sunlight was vivid, the spring colors burning bright as if he'd entered a parallel universe. And then they were climbing the driveway, and he glanced at the grass, thinking his footprints might show in the dew. But there was no dew, and the grass was vigorous, never trodden on. He stopped thinking about the landscape when Debenham and a second plainclothes detective stepped out of an unmarked sedan, parked on the white gravel turning circle in front of the house. He was followed a moment later by three uniforms who'd been waiting in a patrol car.
"Local uniforms," muttered Helen, about to get out. She added, "No one's jumping for joy."
She was right. Solemn expressions all round.
"Maybe Neil's done a runner."
They got out, shook hands, then the local uniforms retreated a short deferential distance, leaving it to the detectives. Hiding a yawn indifferently, Debenham said, "Hate to be the bearer of bad news, esteemed colleagues, but you might have made a wasted trip." All let Helen ask the questions.
"Dr. Neil not home?"
"He's home, all right."
"And he's got a lawyer with him?"
"Oh, he's way past caring about his rights."
"Jerry, cut the crap," Helen said. "What's the story?"
"He's dead." Helen glanced at all, then swung back to Debenham with the whisper of a philosophical shrug. Receiving bad news, receiving late news, false news. All part of the game.
"Murdered?"
"Hard to say."
"What can you say?"
"Looks like he shot himself by accident."
"In the house?"
"Nope."
"Spit it out, Jerry."
A little testy now, Debenham said, "When no one answered at the front or the back, we had a scout around. Neil is tangled in a wire fence over there." He gestured lazily. "Still in his pajamas."
"Weird,"
All said.
"Looks like he shot himself," Debenham said.
"Climbing through a fence with a loaded firearm. It's happened before." He paused. "But what do I know?"
"Dead,"
Helen said. "As in very dead," Debenham said. "Small creatures with sharp teeth have already had a go at him."
"Have you asked for—"
"Helen, I know my job," Crime scene techs are on the way. But is it suspicious or isn't it?